Well, my name is Ken Erickson, and I'm calling this, while it's advertised power of praise, I'm also calling it killing criticism. And that can be used two different ways, that criticism kills, or that we might want to kill criticism. I think many of us have what some people call unfinished business in our lives. And I think some of the things I'm going to share with you today are the result of what I call unfinished business in my own life. But first, let's see if there's any biblical support. Can you think of some verses that might support the concept of why praise is important for our fellow human beings? Anybody think of anything along that line?
I guess the one of, I don't know, just to build the character in other people, or also the thing for yourself is not to become anxious.
Okay, good. Not to become anxious, to help build character in others. That might be Philippians 4:8, whatever is good, positive, true, of good report. If there's any praise, you know, to think on these things, that would be one. What about, you are my own dear son in whom I am well pleased? You know, if God thought that was important to say to his son, maybe that's a model that would be important for us as far as hearing from others or saying to other people also. And then in 1 Thessalonians we find, therefore encourage one another and build each other up. Well done, a good and faithful servant, we find in Matthew. Love one another. And then when you did it unto one of the least of these, you've done it unto me. And then we find also in Paul's letter to the Romans, 16th chapter, something that says, greetings to Rufus, that outstanding worker in the Lord's service, and to his mother, who has always treated me like a son. So there are many examples, I think, and evidences in the Bible that would support the concept of, hey, the power of praise is important. The power of criticism is damaging. Let's see, we do have three seats up in front here, if some of you don't mind. Okay, a few over here also. Okay, I guess I've had some conflicts in my life that on the one hand, I hear, you know, do not withhold good from those to whom it is due. On the other hand, my struggles with my natural self find that I'm sometimes an insecure, striving individual and competitive by nature. Why is it you think we get competitive by nature? Anybody?
Might need praise.
Might need praise, might feel inadequate, and therefore, if I am competitive, I might tend to belittle someone else. You know, be little so I can be bigger. And so this is a tendency, I think, that's on the other hand, some of my problem in the past. A tendency sometimes to be more negative and to neglect some of the needs of others. We've got a couple right up in front here. So I've probably, as you suggest, have yearned some for attention and recognition. I needed convincing signs from my parents that I was worth something and worthwhile. And I believe I did get this from my mother. But from my father, it was something that I continually sought, but never felt satisfied in that area. I wanted my dad to say, I like you. My sister sat in his lap. She had nice long curls and such. I don't remember ever sitting in his lap. So I was probably working and working to do something to merit recognition. Let's see. I think of some other people I've talked to. One lady who's retired now who said when she was young, she was on a farm, and she worked like a man. She said, harder than any woman should probably work. But my dad never said anything positive to me and recognized my good work. One day she heard him say to the neighbor, you know, Ruth does a real hard, good job, works hard. But, she said, he never told me. I worked harder the next day, but I still never heard it. Had a doctoral student from Australia and we're talking about this one day, and he said, I think that any words of praise would have stuck in my dad's throat. So parents are different. And we actually realize after a while, and this writing of the power of praise was a good learning experience for me, I began to realize that my dad raised me pretty much the way he was raised. And if he hadn't known much about the, you know, hey, you're doing a good job, if he hadn't heard that, maybe he thought that wasn't the way I should be raised either. So I began to realize what a power we have in the lives of others, whether we are affirming or whether we are infirming. And I use that word just as an opposite of affirming here. And then there's also, of course, the possibility some of us tend to be neglected, and that can be very, very difficult. But think just for a minute of the possibilities we have in affirming in others or infirming others. And this is probably a little extreme and bizarre in one way, but it's possible. For example, suppose I affirmed two individuals today, and that tomorrow each of those two individuals would affirm someone else. And the next day, each would affirm each time two more people. You realize that in 7 days, 120 people would have been affirmed? That in 14 days, 16,000 people would be affirmed? That in 21 days, 2 million would be affirmed? On the other hand, if we infirm other individuals, the ratio can be the same. Now that's an extreme case, but we need to realize what power we might have in the lives of others. So the goal of this particular book was to spotlight the amazing power, potential we have to build up other individuals, or to, we have the devastating power to damage or destroy or hurt others also. Some people say, well, there are quite a few books out on self-esteem, and there are, and how does your approach differ? Basically, many of the publications out these days talk about how you might improve your self-esteem. The goal that I've chosen here is how you and I might help other people improve their self-esteem. How we might affirm others, how we might become God's agents of change in building the self-confidence of others. I think we need to realize, as I have needed to realize, that if I am acceptable to God as I am, in spite of the fact that I feel unacceptable, then maybe when I can finally buy that truth, then I can accept other people as they are. At the point where I cannot or have difficulty accepting God's complete acceptance of me, then I'm going to be competitive in nature with some of the rest of the people and need to not be constructive, but probably destructive. Some of you may have read some of Keith Miller's and Joyce Landorf's works, and they speak of two categories of people: balcony people and basement people. Active balcony people will cheer you on. They'll recognize you, appreciate you, accept you as you are, commend you, respect you, encourage you, approve or praise. On the other hand, basement people will tend to blame you, find fault, belittle you, tease you, that's a very harmful thing, disapprove, discourage, laugh at you, criticize or reject you. And we find many times, as I look through the various types of words available for affirming or infirming, I found, oh, 2.5 times as many words how we can infirm people as opposed to how we can affirm people. I don't know if that means we use them that much more or not, but there are many more. Then I've added a third category. They had balcony people and basement people, and I don't know quite what to call it. Maybe you'll have an idea. Ground floor people or what? That's a passive situation. Those who don't either affirm or infirm you, but they ignore you, neglect you, are insensitive to you. Neglect is eloquent rejection. To be unseen and unheard, someone has said, is devastating. We know from studies that children prefer to have negative attention, to have no attention at all. And I think a lot of us are just grown-up children or big children. And I've known some people that have, well, when I was principal in Portland, I had a very capable staff member. Larry needed things to do. He needed to have challenges. He needed to have some recognition. If he had none, he was a big burr under the saddle. Give him a job to do. Give him recognition. He was a team member. Neglect was something that he couldn't stand, and a lot of people can't. George Bernard Shaw said that the worst sin toward fellow creatures is not to hate them, but to be indifferent toward them. And what's the result of our neglecting, ignoring people? Well, in one area of youth, age 15 to 24, we find over 4,000 suicides a year. That's one every 2 hours. But in a sense worse than that, there are approximately, according to the best estimates, 500,000 suicide attempts at that age level, which means about one on average of every minute. And following that, to kind of give you the basic feeling of how important affirming is and how devastating infirming is, I'd like to quote just a little bit from Quaist's book, With Open Heart. He tells in here in one section about a friend of his, just lists him as R. R has just told me that Bernard, a priest and a friend, a wonderful, remarkable, generous man of action who gave his all, had died, defeated by depression. He had committed suicide. Stupefied and shattered, I could only think, Bernard, why? Why? Tonight I ask myself, why did they let him do it? We are all responsible. What matters now, and what I'm sure of, is that Bernard died because he lacked that little or large touch of friendship which dispels loneliness and makes a burden seem much lighter for being shared. I'm going to the funeral. I had hesitated. Why go? For him? I can pray for him right here, for his family, friends, myself, perhaps. However, I know that I will be going to very little more than a show. I can already hear the sudden concert of unanimous praise and the miraculous disappearance of all criticism and reservation. Like all sensitive beings, Bernard wanted a bit of approval, a little encouragement. But he would never have believed the amount of praise that's going to be heaped on him now. The tragic thing is that just a fraction of it could have perhaps saved him. The church was packed. Places filled half an hour before the service. Abandonment. I didn't abandon Bernard. I was faithful in my friendship. But it was a silent friendship. I admired his work, but I never told him so. Why? Today, I found some time for my friend, a whole afternoon. I traveled 200 kilometers for him, and without hesitation. I did it for him, but he's dead. I wouldn't have traveled that far for him had he been alive. Why? Why is friendship expressed in front of a coffin and not in front of a living, breathing person who watches and waits? Crippled people who don't know how to love, to speak, to show feeling. Hearts locked in a hard shell. When will I learn to carry around a living, beating heart? Share that to kind of underscore and emphasize, I guess, the importance of contrasting, recognizing people, appreciating them, commending them, as opposed to ignoring them, such as that. Okay. How many of you here can think of someone who was a significant balcony person for you? Remember, they're the ones that are cheering you on. Who is that?
Oh, I just thought you were asking for a show of hands.
Yeah, okay, well, how many can? And then let me think and ask another question as you're thinking of it. Everybody kind of think of somebody who might have been a significant balcony person. How many would raise a hand and say it was a parent? A parent, I'm sorry. Yeah, okay, several hands. How many would say it was a teacher? See, also about the same number of hands. A relative? Uh-huh. Any others that we didn't mention?
Good friend?
Fine, good friend, yeah. Okay, one of my balcony people was Bess Curry, my high school physics teacher. Lots of confidence expressed in me. A shy, and I didn't have much confidence in myself at all. She would give me extra tasks, extra jobs, encouragement, praise. You can go to college, she said. College? Nobody in the family's gone to college. Yes, you can go to college. I've got no money. You can go to college. And if it weren't for Bess Curry, you know, I don't know what would have happened. So I just say, you know, bless the memories of the Bess Currys in our lives. I can't tell her. It's too late. Maybe you've got somebody you can still express appreciation for their help. My Aunt Edith, very positive person. Mow the lawn for Edith and Gus every Saturday. And I can still hear her saying after I had cut around the stepping stones between the sidewalk and the street, "Hey, Gat, come on out and see what Kenny has done. He's cut the step, found our stepping stones," you know. Years and years ago. But that still sticks. And you probably have other people like that that have been very important in your life, or you can be that type of person for other individuals. You can accept the fact that God accepts you, and you're free to accept other people, to love other people, freed to be a balcony person and not just a basement or an ignoring person. A couple of studies I'd like to comment on that kind of support this whole idea of needing recognition and appreciation. One shows that capable employees, good ones, you know, up here, tend to regress and become average employees when they're ignored. And there are lots of ignored employees in this world. The New York transit strike, a few people would get to work. And they found out that the few people that came to work probably did as much as a lot of the other people did who weren't there. I mean, they made up for it. And one of the reasons was, who was at the door welcoming them? The boss. He hadn't talked to them for 10 years maybe, but he's there happy to see them on that day. American Management Association in 1946 came out with a list of 10 factors affecting work. One of them was appreciation for good work. They gave the list of 10 to workers and said, rank order them. Number one for the workers, appreciation for good work. They gave it to the bosses and said, now you prioritize these as you think the workers would prioritize them. Where did they put appreciation for good work? 8th on the list. Now that was 1946. We've certainly learned a lot since then. So it was repeated in West Virginia in 1979, 33 years later. Appreciation for good work was number 2nd, and liking the work was number 1st then. But the bosses still thought it was number 8. So we hadn't learned anything in the intervening years. There was another study of 1,753 events that led to extreme satisfaction on the job. And number 2 on those of the 6 items, recognition and appreciation for good work. Last on the list of those 6, salary. But we negotiate in other areas. Failing to listen is also kind of a lack of recognition and appreciation of another person. Sperry Rand has done some studies in that area recently. And they find out that the typical person on a scale of 0 to 100, with 100 being high, rates himself at the 55th percent level as a listener. And then they find out that if it's the boss talking, it's above 55th percent that they listen. If it's a co-worker, about 55th percent. If it's spouse, below 55th percent. And the more years you've been married, the lower it goes. Well, it's humorous, but it's sad too, you know, if that is a fact in represented here. If affirming is such a positive thing, why do you think that we tend to infirm people? Any feeling about that?
You expect good things, and so that becomes the expected behavior. And if it's anything less than that, you're quick to criticize that.
Okay.
I know with children, you know,
uh-huh.
You expect certain things of them, and when they do them day after day, sometimes you forget to thank, because that becomes
yeah.
standard, acceptable standard. Anything less than that.
Anything less than my standard, probably as a parent, is not that acceptable. And I just want to digress a minute on that, because Mary, that's a good point. We're always happy to have a normal child at birth, right? That's our goal. After that, they've got to be above average. I've never yet found a parent who wanted a child below average. But 50% of the children are always below average, always will be. And are we rejecting 50% of our population because of that? I remember when I was principal of a mother that came in one day and she was unhappy with her daughter's grades. And I did spend some time, talked to the counselor, I talked to the mother, and all the test scores we could find suggested the girl was doing everything she could. I mean, doing as well as she could. I tried to explain this carefully to the mother. And the mother got the point but didn't accept it because she finally said, well, I could accept the fact that my daughter is probably average, but I can't accept the fact that she's below average. Now, all of us are below average in certain areas. I'm below average in painting and car repair, you name it, violins, lots and lots of areas. And everything we meet, everyone we meet, is our superior in some way, if we search those things out, as far as they're concerned. Well, another reason we infirm, I guess, is that it's kind of natural to see the speck in somebody else's eye and ignore the log in our own eye. Particularly if I have low self-esteem, if I'm aware of my weaknesses, which I think probably most of us are, and I begin to compare myself, and then I have to kind of belittle others in order to build myself up. Someone like Lloyd Ogilvie, I've read some of his books, says, it's hard to be up for others when you're down on yourself. So again, accepting God's abundant love, reconciling love, again will help us to get rid of some of the infirming and move more toward the infirming area. Now we do hear words of appreciation, expressions of appreciation. Is it really as grim as I've been painting it, do you think? Let me ask the question, what types of people in society do we normally express appreciations?
Ones to are close to.
Sorry?
Ones who are close to.
Ones to are we're close to is one suggestion. Any other feelings about?
Some that are doing things for you.
Some that are doing things for us. Any
people
other thoughts? What?
Any people that we care about.
People we care about, Anybody else differ from those points of view for any reason?
Performers,
musicians.
The boss. Successful people.
Successful people.
The boss.
Okay, yeah.
People
see,
we put on
pardon?
People we put on pedestals.
Yeah, people we put on pedestals. I happen to feel, and you may agree or disagree, that we tend to give recognition to people sometimes we know the least well. I go to a restaurant and what do I say? You know, give compliments. Well, at first I might, you know, thank the waitress for doing a good job, leave a nice tip and so on. Give my compliments to the chef. And sitting here is Lois, who has prepared 35,000 meals for me. And maybe I haven't thanked her for those, but this person, you know, I don't know, and I say thank them. And performers, sometimes we do that. I've got a feeling sometimes that maybe the last persons we might appreciate could, on the other hand, be those we know the best. Those nearest to us. After all, you know, why should I thank my wife? She married me for better or for worse, didn't she? Remember the case of the fellow who and the wife been married for 20 years, and he'd never told her. Now, Granger already told me he wasn't mad. He said he had another appointment, so that's fine. And the husband had never expressed his love for his wife. And, you know, 20 years of that was more than she could really take, and she finally got the nerve up to ask him, you know, said, you know, do you really love me? Look, he said, when we got married, I told you that I loved you. Whenever anything changes, you'll be the first to know. I remember talking to a fellow church member, within the last several months. His wife was out of town, and we were talking on the phone. We're talking about how fortunate we both were with our wives, you know, the wives we had. We're blessed to have great wives. But then his comment before we hung up was something to the effect that, however, if we tell them, they might get the big head. Say, well, what he's really saying is we can't really tell them this because it might be dangerous. Or it's an excuse for not telling in that situation. We tend to take our family and loved ones for granted rather than with gratitude. And I'm thinking of the fellow who had heard this type of comment when at a seminar. And he realized he really hadn't expressed appreciation to his wife. So he involved in a little overkill, I guess. He bought candy and flowers and went home, you know, and knocked on the door. And wife opened the door, looked at him, and broke down crying. And he said, what's wrong? Everything's wrong today. The washing machine broke down, Bill fell off the bicycle and banged up his knee, the dog ran right through the screen door, and now you come home drunk. Someone has suggested that we try praising our family even if it frightens them at first. I'm afraid if you look very carefully, you see, at yourself, you may find that those nearest and dearest to you are the ones that you may be the last to really express appreciation. And not everybody. I know there are lots of good examples, but look at yourself very candidly in that area anyway. What can we as parents, and of course some of us are beyond that time probably, but a few of the things we might think about in relation to our children. I have a good friend who is a principal up in Alaska, and he impresses on his teachers, catch your children doing something right, as opposed to catch, it's so natural to catch them doing something wrong. Go to the supermarket on Saturday and follow some parent around with some children. It hurts. And he says also, teachers were instructed that when they had a substitute, there was a note there to give the names of the students who were most helpful to the substitute. And he would call a home and tell them, you know, hey, so-and-so helped out today and did a good job. And that reminds me of what a shock that can be. Because a fellow from the National School Public Relations Association told he had been encouraging a teaching staff to do that. And one teacher reported to him later that she had called the home and said, Bill did a real good job today, and the mother cut right in. You've got the wrong number. And they checked a little more and found out it was the right person, and the mother broke down and cried. She says, no one has ever called us from school before unless there's a problem. So one thing, catch the children doing something right. Talk honestly with the children. My oldest daughter, I had to just tell her, I said, hey, I made a lot of mistakes with you, but you had to bring up father. I'd never been a dad before. We had to go through this together. And then I think we have to be cautious about the child that's most like you as a parent. Because that particular child in our family, I was the least tolerant with. The things I didn't like about myself were just right there in front of me, you know, and I could be very short because it was kind of mocking me. I didn't like something and there it was right in front of me. I've had some friends who have had sad experiences. One of my good friends who told me not too long ago that his dad used to say to him, you little rat. Two brothers in the family, his older brother doesn't believe him. You know, he says, oh, Dad, Pops wouldn't do that, he said. But just because they're two children or three children in a family, it doesn't mean they've got the same experience and background. I've got another close relative who heard father say to the wife when didn't know it was being overheard, I really don't like that child. And another one who said to me that she heard, that one should never have been born. You know what damage that can do to a child who carries that throughout life. So carelessness in that position can be very harmful. And then so many times we say to children or adolescents or maybe to others too, that's fine, but you know, no matter what they do, it's not good enough. I see you've got four A's, but you've got a B here. What happened there? There's just no chance to celebrate that which is good because a but comes in there and cuts it away. Okay, yes, sure.
Say in a business situation where there's something that's, most of it's done well, but you know another part's not done so well, and you're supervising someone. I have a little bit of trouble with that because then you have sometimes someone over you that is insisting on, you know, perfection, and I have a hard time handling that situation.
What do you think if I'm your worker, okay? And I'm doing some things well, but there's one thing you want to change. Do you think I will react more favorably if you tell me about some of the good things I'm doing and with some regularity, and then when you come to me with a negative thing, do you think I'll take it better? Or if I only hear about that one negative thing, which way would I do better?
Oh, well, if you hear about good things.
Both. Yeah, be very candid with me. You know, I guess I need to hear the good things. I worked for one person 10 years before I got a note of appreciation. That was a long, dry spell. And people just need to hear it regularly. And they're much, you know, I am less threatened if I've heard good things and know I'm doing pretty well when you bring this problem to me. And if you say, hey, we've got a problem, we need to work on this or something like that. Is that helpful?
Yeah, I guess I'm just looking at it. It still can be very frustrating because I am affirming, you know.
Yeah. Well, it's frustrating to you to talk about the negative.
Yeah.
Yeah, well, I think it's natural, but someone said when...
It's like you want to avoid it all.
Yeah, even a good egg gets a little hard-boiled when they've been in hot water a few times. And it just kind of comes with, you know, more and more experience, that kind of becomes a natural part of it. The other part you mentioned is tough, and that's a perfectionist boss. And I could spend time on that, but we don't have time for that now. That's a tough one. Okay, if you're going to express appreciations to some people, what might be the better way? To do it orally or to do it in writing? Any feelings about that?
Writing.
You like it in writing?
I like it in writing.
And tell me a little bit more why you like it in writing, Mary.
Because then every time I feel bad, I can use it over and over again.
That is so true. It may sound, you know, like, I don't know if I would do that. But that's true. I think it's very true. Written notes suggest a greater involvement on the part of the person.
It took longer to do it. They took some time.
Right. It says, I took some time to think about it and write it down. I probably worded it a little better than I might have mouthed it. It can be shared with others. The one I got after 10 years was from the dean. And I took it home and showed it to Lois. Look, he thinks I'm doing a good job. I had worked just as hard years 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9. But I had no recognition from that point of view. They can be saved and savored later.
Maybe at a 10-year interval.
No, he had no intervals. The reason I say that is he said, I'm taking a leaf out of your book in writing this letter of appreciation because he knew I had been doing it. That was what prompted it, I guess. Well, there's somebody you all know who's been at this, in this particular location. And I had written her a nice note of appreciation, and she had sometime later said, hey, I drag that out and read it when things look low. So that substantiates, you see, what Mary was saying. Then there's, you know, you can, and I'm not saying we shouldn't tell people at all, but if it is really warranted at all, then putting it in writing is important. And then there's even an improvement in that area, whether you send it to the person or you send it to the person's boss.
Can you overdo it?
How many of you feel that you have had recognition overdone in your life? Could I see your hands? I mean, it's a fair question because you hear it a lot. You hear it a lot. It's got to be sincere. You know, if it's laid on, now then it's not so good. Yeah.
I was just going to say that too. It has to be sincere, but I'm going to tell a story on my husband. But he gave me the cutest card, and on the inside it has a cute picture on the other side. Thing together.
Uh-huh.
And I've gotten it for anniversaries, but it's the same card. He never signs it. It just keeps giving it to me. I never know when it's going to appear. He gets it in unexpected times, so we have
sure.
more fun with that card. It's so cute.
Uh-huh. Yeah, I'm glad we're in this thing together. That's fine. Yeah.
It's actually a picture of two little hippos in a hot tub.
Okay, that's all right. Well, on the situation of, you know, notes to the person or notes to the boss, someone has said, if you don't like what I do, tell me. If you like what I do, tell my boss. And following that out, when Lois went to the hospital about 10 years ago, the admitting clerk did a real good job. So I took her name, I saw it on a little tag, and I wrote, not to her, but I wrote to the administrator of Sacred Heart Hospital. And I said what a fine job she had done, because I knew that was a sensitive spot. I used to be on Emmanuel Hospital Board and was sensitive about that. About 2 weeks later, I got a note from the lady. She said, that was a real nice thing you did. What you don't know, however, is my husband is an invalid in a wheelchair. I'm the sole support of the family. I've been on the house cleaning crew for a number of years and just had a chance for promotion to the admission desk. Now, if I'd sent it to her, she couldn't run it up the flagpole, see? But I started with her, came down, different people, oh, hey, we've got a good employee down there. I was driving back on the freeway to Eugene from Southern Oregon one day, and a long, gradual curve, a car came around this way and hit the middle divider, these barriers, you know. Then it hit it again, and then I looked in the rearview mirror, hit it once more. And then I thought, you know, no divider, head-on collision. And I often have a little portable dictator with me, so I just picked it up and I wrote to the State Highway Department, explained what had happened. And about several weeks later, I got a letter from a man named Mr. Verstig, whom I've never met, and he said, that was a nice thing you did. He said, we just never get any notes of appreciation like that. The only thing we ever know about this is the black tire marks, you know, on those concrete dividers. Your letters being routed to the people in design, installation, and maintenance, and all that type of thing. I could give a number of examples to support that, but that might be enough. So, writing notes to those that might be responsible for another person's work can be very helpful. Do many of you write notes of appreciation with regularity? Good. See, some of you do. How many of you have gotten written notes of appreciation in 1984? Can I see your hand? Oh, that's pretty good. That's pretty good. This is maybe an unusual group. Anything outstanding or unusual about one? An unusual source? Unexpected source? Yeah?
I taught handwriting this year, and I had a little boy who always had a better way to do everything. And I was sure that he was the one child who had not gained anything from the class. He was stubborn, and he had his own style. And I finally just sort of said, you know, Donnie is not going to learn to do this. But something clicked, and I let up on him, and he really responded. And I got the cutest thank you note from him, from any of the children. How he really appreciated that I came every week and was sorry that his progress had been slow at the beginning. It was just priceless.
That's good.
And he was the one that I was really concerned about.
Well, and sometimes, you know, in looking, you probably had to look pretty carefully to find something to praise him about. Or it sounds like it. At least you might have had to sleuth a little bit. And some of the rest of us, I think, might have to look at people and say, gee, what can I find to say about so-and-so? But I think about volunteers. We oftentimes forget them. We've probably failed to write the notes promptly, I think, which is very helpful. We need to be specific about what it is we like when we write something. Maybe give an example in there. I do church council retreats sometimes, and one person in a church said, "Hey, I'm going to write one note of appreciation a week for the next year." Well, I wanted to follow up on that. That sounded good. A year later, I checked with her. And she said, "Well, no, I didn't write one every week, but I wrote about half the time." Well, 26 notes, you know, is probably worthwhile. And I said, "How did it go?" She says, "You can't believe the reaction of the people. A number of them cried when they thanked me for this because they didn't know." I said, "I didn't know anyone knew I was doing this." I think of people in our church. One lady, she goes out and walks with an elderly, partially crippled lady every morning from about 7 to 8. No one banners that around. Others who fix the toilets all the time in the church, you know, or whatever it is. They get no attention, no recognition, no credit. Pulling the weeds out. I don't care on any numbers of things that we sometimes overlook. One of my practices, because I've been writing notes for about 30 years now, not only doing it with the time, but also on the first day of November, I start writing one note a day. And I date it this next year, it'll be Thanksgiving 1984. And then about the Monday before Thanksgiving, I mail them. And I'll have a number of them to go out. And I think it's far better received than a Christmas letter. Or even a Thanksgiving card that says, you know, poem in here and then, you know, John at the bottom or something like that. In fact, I'm not too thrilled with Christmas letters that just come, you know, Bill on the bottom. Yes?
I read about a church that did that at Thanksgiving, whole congregation.
Well, is that
wrote
right?
Notes of thanks to different things that had happened. And I know myself, and I really appreciate something, and then too much time goes by, and then I'm embarrassed to say it was so nice.
Uh-huh.
But it would give you a chance to say, "I'm so sorry this is so late, but I really enjoyed something, or I really appreciate something you did," and they more or less put them on the altar, and then the church is responsible for giving them to the people.
I like that. In other words, your church encouraged its members to write notes of appreciation, which went on the altar at Thanksgiving time, and then the church is responsible for distributing them later. And one of the thoughts, you know, that might come to somebody's mind, well, what if someone gets more than someone else? But
you never know.
So you know.
That's
yeah.
Just a big pile.
But you know, that's always the case. You can't always equal things out. And I think so much good is done that way. I call intergenerational infirming. What that really refers to is that, the way I'm raised is the way I might tend to raise my children. And I'll give one example on that. Let me watch the time, yeah. I've got a good friend, and he said his father was a perfectionist. And he psychologically infirmed his wife, because no matter how well she did in anything, meals, work around the house, he never thanked her. It was never enough. It didn't warrant a compliment. My friend is a very intelligent person. He vowed he would not do the same with his wife. But after 10 years of marriage, he realized, and I don't know exactly what brought it to the surface, but it was kind of a critical time. And he realized that he had been doing the same thing, in effect, to his wife as the father had done to his mother. And he said, if it weren't for our religious faith and God's love, he said, the scars might have been too deep. And I think that all of us can be somewhat in that situation like he is. Then the thing that was probably hardest on him again, he noticed that his son, when he got married, was doing the same thing to his wife. And so they had a family conference. And they talked about, you know, grandparent to parent, to son, and there's been a change possible. But without that type of a breakthrough, intergenerational infirming, you know, might go way out into the future. By the same token, intergenerational affirming, being very positive. I've got another friend where the family is so positive, and the children are so positive, you see. That can move on out into the future also. Nonverbal communication, we have to take a look at that in relation to both affirming and infirming. Physical abuse is bad enough. In fact, in Oregon, child abuse, it's been reported anyway, has increased 39% in 11 years. I'm sorry, 3,900% in 11 years. From 71 to 82, it went from 86 to 3,369 cases. Think of the emotional scars there. And yet psychological crippling, I mean, you know, being ignored, might be just as damaging and last just as long in the lives of these individuals. Negative nonverbals, frowning, be one. How about that piercing stare that goes across a room and just melts somebody? Shaking the head no all the time. A tone of voice. In fact, if there's any emotional contact in a message or content in a message, only 7% of it comes through the words and the rest comes through tone of voice or facial expression. You know, if I say to you, you're a great kid, that's one thing. But I say, you're a great kid, tone of voice is entirely different. How about a slap in the face? A beating. And there's still lots of beatings going on. The ultimate nonverbal information, informing, I should say, is assassination. On the affirming side, I suppose, the ultimate affirmation is laying down your life for someone else, which might be very important when we think about our Christian faith. A smile can be very affirming. A pat on the back, or the hold and hug, which has been practiced around here some. And which, in fact, we've been here 19 years. And when I first came here, you know, a hug for someone else I didn't know, I'll pick on Mary again. What if I hug Mary, what will she think? What will Dave think? You know, so on. But I've learned that sometimes the hug is the only thing that really expresses the feeling. I think of, I went to a funeral recently. A daughter of a member of our church, she happened to be of Catholic faith, so when I got to the Catholic church, went ready to go in, another lady was standing there, and she looked ill at ease, and she says, I don't know what to do here. And I said, I don't either, let's go and do it together. So we walked down the aisle and sat, and we talked a little bit before the service started, and she said, I am just like a sister to the mother of the deceased. I hope I don't see her today. Now, she was saying that because she didn't know what to say and what to do. And I said, gee, all I'm going to do, I'm going to give her a hug and say, I'm here because I care. That would be the extent of the words. So nonverbally, that carries a lot more weight than the verbal. And how you shake hands, you know, whether it's the cold fish that you might get somewhere, or a hand clasp and someone puts their other hand on top, you know, to kind of make it a real nice warm feeling. All these are nonverbals. Someone says that today we live in a high-tech and low-touch society. And I think that may be true. And a kind of an interesting aside there from another book, this one, Please Lord Untie My Tongue, Working with Divorced People. A member of our church was divorced. I hadn't talked to her about it. And I went, one Sunday I said to Linda after service, I know you're divorced, but I don't know what to say now. She talked for 20 minutes. She says, no one ever speaks to me about it. It's like an elephant sitting in the room, a white elephant, she said, and everyone ignores it. Then I said to her, hey, Linda, if I put my arm around you, and I often put my arm around people like this, I don't want you to misunderstand. See, I was worried about this. She said, what do you mean? Well, I said, sometimes I understand that people might want to take advantage of someone who's been divorced. Oh, she says, that explains a lot. I didn't ever think about that. She said, now when I meet someone in the restaurant that used to give me a nice hug, they stand away and say, good evening, Linda. And she said, nonverbally, the actions are different. And I thought they were rejecting me. Well, a good friend of mine, Merle Olson, says that we all have great skin hunger, but some of us treat others as if they are untouchable. I'm going to move ahead here, thinking about churches just for a minute. I like the idea you said about churches and expressing appreciation. But I think we still have quite a challenge, you know, a long way to go generally in most churches in expressing some appreciation. I observe after people make presentations, I make an informal survey, how many go up and say thank you? Now, I didn't really watch too carefully last night. I thought Dan Erlander did a superb job with the sermon. I don't know how long he spent on that. I don't know how many people said, hey, that's great. I try to tell our pastor, you know, when frequently, so that he knows that he's being appreciated for the sermons that he gives. What about the choir director, board members? I'm chairman of the church council. I'm not looking for appreciation, but no one during the year said, hey, I'm glad you're chairman of the church council. They're probably glad they aren't. That may be Sunday school teachers. We tried to do a special thing for Sunday school teachers this year. We had little gifts for them. We had a letter that I wrote in behalf of the church council. The pastor signed it also. And we had a special event to recognize their work. We hope to do more things like that. The financial secretary, the one who opens all the envelopes and counts the money and keeps track of it, makes the financial reports. The cook, those who do the cooking, all of these individuals. Then what about in our church, the loners? The people who haven't won their spurs by doing any task because we haven't asked them to do it yet. Or the different person who comes in. Someone comes in with a man with one earring, and I'm sure that half the congregation might say, what's that? We are very hesitant sometimes to let other people know that they're welcome. There's an old Welsh proverb about expressing, that it talks about expressing appreciation in church, I think, and that is, if thou wouldst have praise, die. We've already touched on that one, haven't we, in that quote from Coist. What can we do? Well, I think we've got to be alert to those who hurt, to those who have special needs. And I also have my own personal conviction that sometimes those persons who may look like they have the world by the tail might be the ones that need the affirming the most. I think we're all great mask wearers. And if I feel insecure, I'm probably going to project the image that everything is in good order. May not be true, but anyway, don't get fooled by these facial expressions that have everything under control. I was in a seminar with an associate dean of a medical school one time, and I got to resent him a little bit at first because he was in control of everything, you know. And then after a couple of days, he broke down and cried at one time, and he said, my problem is there's a little boy inside of me, and I'm always trying to keep him hidden so that others won't see the little boy. Well, then he was human. I've been his good friend ever since. We understood each other. But if a person has that, you know, I've got it all made mask on, it's like trying to pick up a greased bowling ball without any holes in it. You can't get a grip on a person like that. And I think one of the disservices we project and have toward other people is to not be honest with them. In some of the small group discussions that Lois and I have had at our home, we called one the Strugglers Group. And early on, we admitted to some of the problems that we had from all types. One silly one, you know, how do you put the toilet paper in a roll? Coming out this way or coming out this way? Her family did it this way. My family always did it from the back, you know, and so on. And from those little differences on up. And people say, oh, you know, you have some challenges in your home? Oh, yeah. Oh, we just thought that, you know, you didn't have, you know, it looked like you had everything all in order. Or how do you squeeze a toothpaste tube in the middle, like mash it, like my wife was used to doing? Or do you roll it up neatly from the bottom, like I was used to doing? Well, we need to be honest with each other and admit some of the challenges that we have, you know. So anyway, the most confident, the most assured looking might be the ones that need some attention and the direction from you, help. Well, a couple of things, and I'll wind it up, and then if we'll officially dismiss, but because some of you may want early dinner, and if you don't, stay, and I'll be here for any questions you have. I like this one from Franklin Jones, a little quote. Honest criticism is hard to take, particularly from a relative, a friend, an acquaintance, or a stranger. I can live 2 months on one good compliment, said Mark Twain. We flatter those we scarcely know and please our fleeting guest, but render many a heartless blow to those we love the best. And then someone who read my book Or I send him one. Thank you for sending me a copy of your book. I'll waste no time reading it. Then I'd like to wind up. It can't be taken two ways, can it? From the last page here, kind of winds up some of the thoughts here. It is God's love that moves us to love one another, to look for hidden potentials, to encourage and praise, to increase the influence of good in the world. St. Paul said in 1 Thessalonians, therefore, encourage one another and build each other up. Encourage the timid. We've got those in our congregations. Help the weak. Be patient with everyone. Always try to be kind to each other. Christ has put into the hands of each of his followers the power that changes lives, a power for good that leaves its mark on all future generations. That power for good needs only to be unleashed to transform the lives of individuals, families, and nations. Who can do it but those who have experienced the power of the good news in their lives, who have received the affirmation of God? If not you and me, who? If not today, when? Well, we have about 3 minutes for any questions or additional comments, and then we'll break it off, and someone have something to help us with some good ideas. Yeah.
Sometimes if you feel like you've really done a good job and really nobody really recognizes, I figure the Lord recognizes. And I did it because he gave me the ability to do it. So that's one way of recognizing.
Yeah. I don't think we should overlook that. I appreciate that. In fact, it's one thing that I had in the notes and didn't use, and that is that God is a balcony person. Yeah. And we don't want to forget he's in the balcony. Very good point.
We probably need to learn to affirm ourselves also. To admit to ourselves that we're good in ourselves.
Yeah. That's kind of hard for some of us, maybe for the way we were brought up. You know, I don't know what it is, but it's something that I wasn't ever to kind of look to myself as doing anything particularly good. That was wrong, to have pride. Pride meant you couldn't accept yourself too well, I guess. So we do have to, you know, if God accepts us as we are, then we are acceptable in the right place, huh? Anybody else have one thing to add? Okay, then that's it. And if anyone wishes to stay, fine. The rest of you, dinner hour. And thanks for coming on a nice day.
Thank you.